Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for an advocacy conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Advocacy is critical in creating any type of change, and often it's a grassroots effort that makes things happen. I encourage you to listen to episode number 86 with Candace Leitner, founder of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and her advocacy wisdom in creating a movement. The advocates that are my personal moral compass for change are parents, parents who lost loved ones to drugs. I listened to those parents with the opioid prescription epidemic way before the CDC jumped in to create opioid prescribing guidelines. Parents were the first to sound the alarm on opioid overprescribing. I now listen to parents who lost children to fentanyl. These parents are screaming out and demanding action. I also listen to parents whose children died of cannabis-induced psychosis and suicide. Their voice is not yet heard, but their cry is growing. Advocates have power when they organize and contact their congressional and local leaders. There's a lot that they can do. Advocacy helped increase treatment for opiate use disorder. Advocacy X'd the X waiver, a government bureaucracy and a barrier to prescribe buprenorphine, a medication for opiate addiction. And now parents are advocating for increased consequences for fentanyl dealing, for declaring fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction as our country is being invaded and under attack by fentanyl. And they're advocating for consumer protection on cannabis products with warning labels, potency caps, and products that look like children's candy. How do parents and others bring their pain into purpose for advocacy? To learn more about advocacy and the drug crisis, I reached out to Libby Jones. Libby Jones is the Program Director of Global Health Advocacy Incubator's Overdose Prevention Initiative. That means Libby is in the trenches of Capitol Hill and Washington, D.C., working on federal policies related to the drug crisis. Prior to joining GHAI, Libby served as the Government Relations Officer at the Pew Charitable Trust's Substance Use Prevention and Treatment Initiative. That's where I met Libby and was so impressed by how knowledgeable she and Pew was about emergency medicine and the difficulties with opioid addiction that related to our profession. Libby has extensive experience working in the U.S. federal government with various positions in the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, Department of Commerce, and Department of Justice. To learn more about Libby Jones, check out the High Truth show notes. Libby Jones, welcome to High Truth.
Hi, thanks for having me, Dr. Lev.
I'm very excited to see you. Every time I see you, I'm excited to see you. We met a long time ago when you were working for the Pew Foundation. And out of all the different advocacy groups that we meet through ONDCP, you really stood out in really understanding emergency physicians, right? People, you know, talk to different groups and they say whatever, but I felt like you had an understanding. You like listened enough to actual doctors, you know, boots on the ground, that you understood those challenges. And that's important because then you knew how to fix them. So I was very impressed.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, that feels like forever ago that we were initially starting the conversation for what became the MAD Act. I mean, that does feel like forever ago, but it really wasn't that long. It was, you know,
5 years. I don't know.
5 years ago. It wasn't that long. Yeah.
Right. So I want our audience to get to know you a little bit. You studied human rights and political science in the UK. How did that beginning of your path lead you now to working on the issue of drugs?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I am a native of West Virginia. I'm a very proud daughter of Southern West Virginia, the kind of the coal fields areas. And so working in overdose prevention is kind of a passion project for me. This is something that I've seen how it has affected my home state and my hometown and my own family. And I am extremely lucky to be able to do this every single day. As you pointed out, my academic background is in human rights. Every day I tell my team, I sound like an attorney or I sound like a doctor, but I'm not. I am none of those things. I'm an advocate. I am a fighter. And that's what I have dedicated my career to over the last almost 10 years now. Prior to being an advocate in substance use, I was a career bureaucrat. I've been in DC, working in DC for almost 25 years now, if I do the math. And I worked in the Justice Department. I worked at the Commerce Department. I worked at the Food and Drug Administration. And all of that experience has really helped me kind of understand the bureaucracy. It helped me understand kind of how the sausage was made in DC and kind of how policies get put together. And I kind of draw on that time plus kind of, you know, the fact that I have a passion for this issue. And that's how I run the show over here at the Overdose Prevention Initiative.
That's great. And I know why I like you, because you're a fighter.
I'm a fighter.
I like There's fighters.
You can say that, you know?
Yeah, but you know, the fact that you know the inside makes you know how to change it. Yes. Which is, that's important. I want to kind of see if you can draw analogies, because you did spend time in London and the United States. And do you see, or maybe it's been too long, any differences in comparison between drug culture and politics, or is sausage here and sausage in London the same thing?
Well, that's a really interesting question. You know, I think that the United States, you know, has really, you know, particularly now that we have been drawn in to fentanyl and all of the challenges that we're facing now are so unique compared to the rest of the world. The challenges that we have in the United States right now, we have, you know, seen how other countries have adapted, but they just are not seeing the acute loss of life that we're seeing here in the United States. And I do think it puts us in a very unique class where we have to come up with our own solutions, because I think the problem in the United States looks very different than it does in other places. But yeah, that's actually something that I personally would like to learn more about, to kind of take the experience that I now have in the United States and go to those other countries and learn more about how they've addressed this issue. I know that we work with folks, researchers who are starting to kind of delve into that. And that I think that's just such a fascinating topic to see how other countries have addressed this problem. But again, we are in a unique class. We are in a unique situation here, because there's no other country that's dealing with overdose death at the size and scope and scale that we are here in the United States. And that's why, you know, we really have to come up with our own solutions to meet our unique problem.
I think you're really right. And maybe one day, maybe you could come with me. You have to be invited. But this will be my second year. I'm going in March to Vienna at the United Nations, the Commission on Narcotic Drugs. And it is fascinating to meet people from around the world and see what their challenges are. And I was really shocked that the center of the conversation internationally is about marijuana and not a word about fentanyl. It was impressive.
It is. I mean, and if you just look at the data for the United States, we are such an outlier from all other countries. just again, 80, more than 80% of our overdose deaths are attributable to opioids. And it's fentanyl that is really driving that. So I am fascinated by that. I would love to go to Vienna and talk to other folks from other countries and see how they've dealt with this, because I think there are just lessons learned that we need to hear. We need to see how other folks have done it, see what's working in other places. Because right now, I mean, you're an ED doc, you know, triage, right? Right now we are in triage mode. We have to kind of figure out, you know, who is at the most, you know, highest risk. And we need to figure out what, you know, kind of aggressive policy changes we need to stop, you know,
stop the bleed. Yeah.
Stop the bleed. Exactly. Right.
Yeah. But I think we also need to fill the hole what's causing the bleed. But I want to get into that later. Yeah. What is the Overdose Prevention Initiative, which you head? Tell us about that.
Yeah. So the Overdose Prevention Initiative, we are part of a group called the Global Health Advocacy Incubator. So GHAI is a nonprofit advocacy organization that actually works across the globe to advocate for policies that prevent death and disease. The Overdose Prevention Initiative, we are the first US project at GHAI. So we're based here in DC, and we work with Congress and with the administration to advance policies that will address what is becoming, you know, a leading cause of preventable death in the US, which is our nation's overdose crisis.
Number one cause of death, age 18 to 35. Is fentanyl in the United States.
And, so, you know, we are a very small team. There's only four of us total at the initiative. But, you know, we are working really hard every day to advance federal policies that would address disparities, inequities, and stigma that are kind of inherent in our drug treatment system, and hoping that we can get more people into treatment with the ultimate goal of reducing overdose death.
So, Libby, is this a partisan initiative?
We are completely nonpartisan. We meet with folks from both sides of the aisle pretty much every day. We are, you know, the decisions that we make in terms of what we're advocating for are completely based just on evidence, where what the evidence is showing, you know, those at the highest risks, we are following the evidence, and that's how we're making those decisions. We are happy to work with anyone and everyone who wants to come to the table and talk about this.
And who funds the initiative?
We are funded by the Bloomberg Philanthropy. So Bloomberg Overdose Prevention Initiative funds our work. And then we also work with a group, a consortium of other kind of researchers, academics, and folks like that who help us kind of inform our work, which is, it's a great partnership.
That's great. And you're, do you have like several pillars or key projects that you're focused on? You mentioned stigma and treatment.
We are really focused on treatment. Again, like it's all about triage, right? It's about trying to find the policies that will have the highest impact on the people who are at highest risk. So we right now are looking at two areas where we feel that there is the greatest need. The first is in jails and prisons. So we are, you know, we've looked at the evidence out there, and we're looking for those evidence-driven intervention points. And jails and prisons are really key to that. You know, there's research out there that says that Americans who are recently released from jail are up to 129 times more likely to die of an overdose in the weeks following release from jail. But yet we know that if people are given access to treatment in jail, then not only are, you know, if they're stabilized on medication, when they are you know, reenter the community, they have a significantly higher chance of surviving. They also have significantly lower risk of reoffending. You know, the recidivism rates go down. But we really feel that enabling access to treatment in jails and prisons is something that, as a nation, we really need to make a priority. So we are currently advocating for two bills that would bring Medicaid funded services into jails and prisons to help the jails provide these services. So one is the Reentry Act that would restart a Medicaid beneficiary's benefits 30 days prior to release to help get them connected to treatment, connect them to community services on the outside, and get them stabilized on medication. The other is a bill called the Due Process Continuity of Care Act, and that would allow Medicaid beneficiaries to stay on Medicaid prior to conviction. Because what I think a lot of people don't know is that from the moment you're arrested, you lose your benefits. You know, your health care is the responsibility of the jail or prison that is currently holding you. And so folks are getting disconnected from treatment if they're currently in treatment at the time of arrest. We really think that this is a really critical intervention point.
Yeah, that is a high-risk population. And the connection, you're right. And it makes sense, biologically, because if you're not using a drug, or especially opioids while you're away from the drug supply, then your receptors upgrade. And if you go out and now use the same exact dose that you did before because you have the cravings, then you could be dead.
Exactly. And so many people are. So many people are losing their lives within a week or two of release, you know, that they are no opioid naive when they are released. I can't even imagine the stress that they must be experiencing. And then to go and use the same dosage they were taking before, unfortunately, for thousands of Americans every year are lost because of that. And we really think that that's a critical intervention point. Where there's federal policies that can improve that.
That can work.
Mm-hmm. Right. Some things can be fixed with federal legislation. Some things can't. And you're kind of the expert on that. But how do you do that? When you know, anybody who watches TV or picks up their phone or anywhere says that there's a lot of partisan fighting. Yeah. I mean, sometimes it feels like these are a bunch of kindergartners, like fighting each other and can't get along and can't use your words.
and act mature.
Sometimes it's just funny, but it's sad. So with that state, how do you navigate that? How do you get people to agree?
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes the best thing the federal government can do is just get out of the way. So sometimes it's not proactive policy. It's not proactively changing the legislation. Sometimes it's just legislation is needed to remove barriers and get the federal government out of the way, which is, the case for the MAD Act. But you are exactly right. The Schoolhouse Rocks version of how a bill becomes a law is no longer in effect, right? There's no such thing as regular order anymore, which makes it really difficult for advocates, you know, like ourselves to navigate this situation. There are razor thin majorities in both houses, which I think really exacerbates that kind of ugly partisanship.
Wait, tell me again, what is it that makes it so ugly?
Well, it's because there's only they're really, really slim majorities in both houses, right? And so all the parties, in order to pass anything that is going to be partisan, every single member has to vote, right? You can't have a single member of either a Republican or a Democrat, depending on who's sponsoring the measure. There can be no one who votes outside of that block.
Isn't that better, though? Gets you more moderate.
What we need policies. Is bipartisan. Well, that's, of course, that's the logical side of this, is that in theory we should be bringing both sides together because everything has to pass in a bipartisan manner. But we're in an election year, and it's ugly and it's dysfunctional at this point. But I think we can't lose sight of the fact that, you know, over 100,000 Americans died last year of an overdose. And ONDCP predicts that without significant policy change, that number could go up to 165,000 a year. And it's really, really important. And this is the advantage we have as advocates in this space. overdoses impact every state, every congressional district. It impacts Americans on all ends of the political spectrum. And I hold out hope that this is the single issue that can really kind of unite both parties. And I think that
you would think so, right?
You would think so. Because I think what we're hearing, you know, I have met with hundreds of congressional offices over the last year, and both Republicans and Democrats pretty squarely down the middle. And there's not one of those offices that would say they're not 100% committed to this issue. And every single office, when you meet with them, say that their member is feeling pressure from their constituents to move on this issue. Because of that, more than 100,000 Americans who died of an overdose last year, every single one of them leaves behind a family member and friends who love them and who are telling their stories.
Right.
And there's more than 20 million Americans out there who are in recovery. So each of those individuals also are a testimony to the fact that treatment works. And I think, you know, you can hear this getting louder and louder and louder. And I think what we're seeing now in the, you know, looking into the 2024 election is that voters consider this to be a really high priority issue. And there was actually, it's 4 years old now, but I think it holds pretty true. But the University of Maryland did a study or survey in 2020. And what they found was that it was an overwhelming bipartisan majority of those surveyed said that they felt it was a high priority for the federal government to ensure that people who need treatment get treatment. So the numbers that came out of that study was as much as 8 in 10 Americans surveyed believe that the federal government should be working on this issue. And that was 2/3 of Republicans and almost all of the Democrats who were surveyed. And so I think that our members of Congress are hearing this. They hear this drumbeat. And I do feel that there's pressure to get things done. So I haven't given up hope. I'm still hopeful that we can make some progress on some of these issues.
Right. And the fact that you come from a Bloomberg-funded organization, does that work against you when working with Republicans or no?
I don't think so. I think that we bring just the facts, right? We are, you know, we are nonpartisan. And I think that there are, every office wants to find the solution. I think that another, you know, for everybody listening, one thing I want folks to know is that here in Washington, don't ever count anybody out. That there are offices who advocates like ourselves would never go into because they just assume that the door is going to be shut in their faces. They assume that their policies will not be heard. And I have not had that experience at all in any member offices that I've gone into. Everyone is looking to find a solution, and they, I mean, I do find that this is the one kind of subject matter where folks want to hear what are the possible solutions, because they're really trying, they're really searching.
Yeah, that's good to hear. Yeah. And I think you come about it, like you say, these are in a nonpartisan, this is, it really is an all American problem. And it's an American problem. It's not a European problem. It's our problem.
Exactly.
But I also feel like we're being attacked. We could talk about other ideas of prevention of overdoses, and there's a large group of parents who call it not overdoses but poisoning, right? If you're mm-hmm. if you're taking a Xanax that you thought was a Xanax and you drop dead, you know, you were killed.
Yeah.
But talk about a success story, one that got us together.
I know.
Which was Xing the X waiver. And I think there was a little, you know, partisan kindergarten fighting in the playground.
Oh, that a little bit. This is one of my favorite things to talk about is the work that we did and you and I worked together on the MAD Act.
Yeah.
Because I think it really is a great case study on effective policy. Xing the X waiver is one of the things.
And give us some background. Not everybody knows what the MAD Act is.
Sure, sure.
And or even what the X waiver is. Although, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So let's start off with a kind of an understanding, first of all, of what is medication for opioid use disorder. So the risk of fatality from overdose is decreased significantly, like as much as 80%, in patients who receive medications to treat their opioid use disorder. Yet only about 12% of Americans who would benefit from that treatment actually receive it. And so we as kind of advocates have to kind of address that. And part of that treatment gap was caused or is caused by the fact that there are onerous federal regulatory barriers that make it needlessly difficult for people to access those medications. So one of those medications is buprenorphine. Which is Suboxone, Sublatex, are the brand names. But buprenorphine is a medication that has been proven to not only reduce your cravings for opioids and withdrawal symptoms, but it actually prevents you from overdosing. So this medication truly is a miracle for people who have suffered from opioid use disorder. But until the passage of the Mainstreaming Addiction Treatment Act in 2022, healthcare practitioners they were required to receive additional training, and they had to undertake a months-long registration process in order to obtain a special registration from the DEA, known as the X waiver, to be able to prescribe it. So what I find completely mind-boggling about this was that, you know, healthcare practitioners could prescribe opioids, you know, very potent opioids that can get you addicted.
There's some Dilaudid and some morphine and
exactly without those same restrictions, but medications that actually prevented you from overdosing and could treat your opioid use disorder, you had to go through those extra hoops. And so I really enjoyed through the process of this, meeting lots of doctors like you, Dr. Lev. And, you know, one of the things I learned very quickly was that doctors don't like a lot of extra paperwork or a lot of extra DEA oversight, which was what this X waiver created. And as a result, what happened was, as a nation, we created this opt-in system. So only about 7 to 10% of U.S. physicians actually had one of these X waivers and could treat patients with opioid use disorder. And, you know, again, any DEA, any practitioner with a DEA license could prescribe powerful and highly addictive opioids for pain. And so when we started the charge to pass the MAD Act, only about 40% of US counties had even one waivered prescriber. And what I think is, you know, kind of sobering for me when I think about this is that Congress created the X waiver. They created it in a bill called the Data 2000 Act. And in the 20 years between the passage of Data 2000 and the passage of the MAD Act, over 1 million Americans died of an overdose because we made it really difficult to get this medication. And to, you know, as you know very well, especially being in the emergency department, to combat this crisis, we need all hands on deck. And with the passage of the MAD Act and the removal of that X waiver, we went from 130,000 practitioners to 1.8 million practitioners who could treat opioid use disorder overnight.
Right.
Which is just, you know.
Well, it makes sense. I remember advocating saying, oh, well, you know what? We got COVID. It's a new disease. Should I take an 8-hour course?
Before you can treat anyone.
Or can I just like learn? Because there's ways doctors learn new diseases, new medications all the time. We do that throughout our entire careers. And you know, any doctor can prescribe insulin, right? Yeah. And glucose if there's too much insulin. We don't create barriers for that. And, you know, probably any doctor should be able to treat, you know, diabetes, yeah, high blood pressure, and some patients are difficult, and those need the specialists. So we still need the specialists.
Absolutely.
But we opened the door, and that just made sense. And I don't know if you knew this, like, interesting little fact, but then Senator Biden did the DATA 2000 Act, and then President Biden
got rid of it.
Yeah, he put it in, he took it out.
Yeah, well, this is one of the few policies that President Biden and President Trump agreed upon, right? This is the one thing.
But that's where the little kindergarten things, I think, happen, because President Trump did it. Yeah. He removed the X waiver. And then as soon as Biden got into office, like anything Trump related, there's so much Trump hatred out there. It's like anything he did was wrong and was undone, even if it was popular and favorable.
This is where the DC bureaucrats and all the DC lawyers take a look at these things and say, well, we need to do it. You know, Congress created this.
Right. And we got to. Right. But it took them 3 years. How many people died in those 3 years?
Well, you know, it's interesting because actually it passed DATA 2000 passed in or was created the X waiver in 2000. And almost immediately there were attempts to repeal or amend it. So in 2006, Senators Paul and Markey. So this is another thing that I think is fascinating. You look at these partnerships that come from very unexpected corners. So you don't expect Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky and Senator Markey from Massachusetts to come together and, you know, be not only on the same page, but to fight for the same policy. But they fought to repeal it as early as 2006. And then it was negotiated again as part of the Support Act in 2018. And then it had been introduced in, I think, two or three other Congresses. And that's how long it takes to get some of these bills moved.
I think COVID gave it a good kick in the butt.
And I think, you know, the other thing that made 2022, the effort in 2022 different, was that there was a very coordinated and active coalition. The one thing, and this is why I think the MAD Act is a phenomenal case study in how to be an effective advocate, is that in the end, the MAD Act was endorsed by 540 stakeholder groups. It included the National or the American Medical Association, the National Association of Attorneys General, the National Sheriff's Association. You had public health groups, you had law enforcement groups, you had faith-based groups, you had all of these different, this odd collection of groups that all came together and said, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And that's magic that I wish I could bottle and bring to other issues. And
there was compromise going on, like, because there was a lot of, you know, being in DC, being a doctor, I got to really see and be shocked by the amount of doctor bashing that goes on, and saying, well, you know, we need to train those doctors. Well, those doctors, and people don't take accountability that you forced those doctors into prescribing in the first place. Yeah. But and so they didn't want to get rid of, they were holding on to this 8-hour education thing. And I remember saying that 8-hour education got us into this opioid prescription problem in the first place. I mean, doctors in California, I was mandated to take courses on prescribing, and those government mandated courses on physicians, you know, government should not be playing doctor because things change from year to year. I mean, I took, you know, when we were in a room, I'd say, who took the 8-hour course, the government mandated course? Who in the room who's voting to do this on the entire medical profession took the course? Nobody would raise their hand. Yeah. And they don't realize that things change, and those type of bureaucracies, that's not how we learn medicine or practice medicine. So there was that kind of compromise.
And as a doctor, you know more than anyone that buprenorphine is a very, very safe medication. This is not...
way easier than figuring out insulin dosing or all those new blood pressure medications that are out on the market. There's a lot more way more complicated things that we've learned over the years.
But the legacy of having that X waiver, we're still dealing with today, because what happened, and I think you see this in the medical profession every day, is that it stigmatized that medication because there was no other medication.
That's true.
That you had to do an 8-hour training and get a special dispensation from the DEA to prescribe.
Right.
That there are doctors who assumed that there was
something. No, they still do. I mean, I worked yesterday and one of our OBs called and they said, hey, I have this woman. I'm discharging from the hospital, but I need to write her for this Suboxone thing. And I said, and I don't know how to do that. I said, you could do it. Like, you could do it. Just go to the computer, click, click, just like any other medications. And there's no barrier. She didn't know that yet. And she needed to hear that. From an ER doctor, it's like it's okay.
So important. We just scream it from the rooftops that the X waiver isn't there anymore, and you can treat patients with
OTD. And you need to be sympathetic. Again, I'm always defending physicians who are like, well, they all should do it now. It's like, wait, there is an educational gap. You have to be, you know, sympathetic to that this is something new. And it's tricky. It's not just like, oh, here, give everybody 8 milligrams. There are some nuances to it. There are risks to it. There are things you need to know, but nothing that we can't do. We can figure it all this out. We've gone to medical school, learned way more complicated things, but you know, understand that there is an educational gap and it's up to us to fill that gap, and it will be filled.
Absolutely. And you know, this policy was in place for 22 years. And it's going to take a lot. It's not going to take overnight to get to untrain folks who
yeah.
think a certain way about it.
And yet, so I'll tell you the story about the OB who like, I can't write this medication. I also gave a lecture to first year pharmacy students and they had no idea what an X waiver was. So the new generation will be like, what? You did that? That's stupid. Like, who thought of that?
You know, the other thing is that once we got the law, it's one of those weird points where law enforcement and public safety, who are public health and law enforcement, are typically not on the same side of any issue. And on this issue, they really came together. And in the end, we did an analysis, which I just think is fascinating to me. But we did an analysis of all the bills that had been introduced in the last Congress. So there's like 24,000 bills or, you know, in that neighborhood. And if you look at just how many members of Congress co-sponsored the MAD Act, it was the 31st most popular bill out of 24,000. And you look at that list of co-sponsors, and like, when else are you going to see Bernie Sanders and Marsha Blackburn both putting, you know, co-sponsoring the same bill? You know, and I think that is, again, why I think I have so much hope for advocacy in this particular issue area. You know, I know that DC is very broken. Trust me, I live in DC. I see this every day. But this one case study really gives me hope because it was not easy. Like I told you, we had introduced this bill in 3 Congresses. I affectionately call the MAD Act the bill so nice they introduced it thrice because it took 3 times to get it across the finish line. But in the end, it really did reach a consensus point, but it took a lot of work to bring together this coalition of, you know, these odd bedfellows who were all saying, this doesn't make sense. And I think we can get there on other topics as well.
By the way, I love that partnership between public health and public safety. It's actually my favorite thing because we learn so much from each other. And in San Diego, and I took this from something we started while I was on DCP called CREDO, Community Response to Drug Overdose. At the time, it was a combination from ONDCP, the National Security Council, the Department of Homeland Security, in creating a standard. Oh, maybe I'm putting ideas in your head too, but creating a standard for responding for overdose clusters, just like we do for active shooters, and creating that a voluntary national standard. Anyway, it didn't happen. Administrations changed. But I took that concept to San Diego, and I lead a committee called CREDO in San Diego. And every month we meet together, public health and public safety, looking at our community. What can we do together? How can we cross silos?
And that's one reason why we're now working in this jail and prison space, because when you go and you one of the things that our group did was 2 weeks ago, we organized a jail visit for members of Congress to go to a program in Fairfax County, Virginia, that is offering a jail program that's offering medication and is offering counseling and treatment. And to bring those members of Congress to the jail and have them spend an hour with the inmates, learning from their experiences and learning about how, you know, how much hope they had for their future post-release, because now they were on the right path. Those are the types of activities that our group at the Overdose Prevention Initiative is really working on. You know, we are advocating for these bills, but really what we're working on is combating stigma on Capitol Hill. And we do that by education. We're educating members of Congress. We are bringing people with lived experience, because that is that's where policy change is really going to happen.
So let's, if you don't mind, I want to discuss some other ideas. Is there anything else that you're big that you're, that I want you to share with the audience that you're working on? You said jail and treatment in jails and the other big.
Jails, treatment. We're also looking at methadone. So, you know, buprenorphine, of course, we need to make sure that the X waiver is, you know, now that it's out of the way, that, you know, folks are getting access to buprenorphine. But methadone is incredibly important as well, especially with fentanyl and the rise of fentanyl. We need to make sure that folks who are getting access to methadone as well.
But don't forget the lessons with methadone. Back in the good old days, when opioid prescriptions were killing American, it was like, you know, a significant percentage less than what we're dealing with now with fentanyl. Yeah. If there was one single drug, most people, and I studied, I did research called the Death Diaries, where I looked at every single person who died of a medication and looked at 12 months of prescription before they died. And I did this several times. And the number one drug that people would die of by itself would be methadone.
Yeah.
And so it has a long half-life. And has a much more dangerous profile than other opioids. As a matter of fact, if somebody overdoses on methadone, they have to be admitted to the hospital, because it'll outlast by, you know, 24 hours the naloxone. They have to be admitted.
Absolutely. And we are very, very well aware of the data from the early 2000s, late 90s and early 2000s, when that was, you know, when methadone was being overprescribed for pain. So, you know, we always have to be very cognizant of that and the risks. But, you know, there's also a lot of data out there that is showing that methadone is the most effective medication we have for fentanyl. And so we need to find those policies that will increase access to methadone for those who need it, but in, you know, responsible ways. So we are advocating for the Modernizing Opioid Treatment Access Act. So if you, back in December, the Senate Help Committee looked at this bill. And what they did was they passed a version of the bill that has these guardrails on the bill, so that only board certified addiction medicine specialists and addiction psychiatrists could prescribe methadone, according to the SAMHSA rules for take-home doses. And so I think that that is a really important first step. Let's start with the specialists. You know, to your point, Dr. Lev, earlier about how we need specialists for complex cases. So this bill would limit those prescribing privileges outside of an OTP to just those addiction medicine specialists.
And I think for now that that's the right way to do it, because I would not want to see methadone opened up for everybody after just not even 10 years ago, we had a peak deaths were from methadone more than any other opioid.
And so, that's why we are supporting that policy.
Yeah. But the specialists should have all the tools in the tool shed, right?
Yeah.
They should be able to.
And you know, and hopefully an addiction medicine, a board certified addiction medicine specialist and addiction psychiatrist are providing those services. And that's why I think that MOTAA is a very small step forward, but it's a responsible first step in kind of opening access that in that area. So we did a congressional briefing on methadone last week, where we did a methadone 101, because a lot of folks
What is that?
We just did a 101, just a we're going to educate members of Congress and their staff on what is methadone, because there's a lot of misunderstanding about it. I feel like there was a lot of effort in the lead up to the MAD Act to educate members about buprenorphine. Yeah. And we really did break through that ceiling and made buprenorphine a whole lot more, members of Congress were a lot more comfortable with that.
Yeah.
But methadone is very misunderstood. So we're working on education for
and
that.
And it has to be carefully done. You know, mm-hmm. I know we've had a physician we know who, like, you know, doctor patient came in and wanted pay meds, and they got only 6 methadone and they just dropped dead. Mm-hmm. From 6 pills. So you have to be, mm-hmm. again, it has to be compliant patients or in an OTP clinic where there is that safety.
And that's one reason why we like MOTAA is because, you know, SAMHSA has their rules for take-home dosing. You know, they have their guidelines for prescribing to stable patients. And this would conform to that, but there's nothing in this bill that would take that away. But then also, like, let's let the specialists, operate here. And it is very limited. But again, I think it's a baby step. I think it's a step in the right direction. But it has these guardrails in it. And, I think it's an important first step. So those are the kind of the two things that we're actively
main things that we're
advocating on. But in general, we're really trying to, we're hosting different congressional meetings, congressional briefings on topics that we feel are very important. Because I think members of Congress and their staff have a lot to learn. I think, Dr. Lev, your experience in D.C., I think you, I heard this from you when you were talking about your meetings with members of Congress. There's a lot of misinformation, disinformation, or just naivety about how to address this issue.
Right.
Yeah.
And there are controversies on how to tackle it. So I want to run some ideas by you.
Okay.
First of all, easy peasy one. Okay. Senator Liu has a bill out there on fentanyl testing. When I left ONDCP, came back to California, I became my own advocate and took what I learned to, you know, from the inside to do things and wrote my first bill on including fentanyl in a urine drug screen in a hospital setting. It doesn't mandate testing. It's like, if you're going to get a test that includes marijuana, PCP, and cocaine, why would you not include fentanyl? And that got bipartisan support in California. It went into effect within a few months of passing, and now we're a year later, there's been no complaints, and it's a 75-cent test. And I had to do the back research. Really, I learned from you, Libby, like learning the obstacles, what does it take, and doing that research, and then educating, because I realized when things are so simple, it's an educational gap.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like we did a little pilot study. Look, it happened in San Diego. Now it's standard of care San Diego, and then taking it to California. And now Maryland passed the same thing. Pennsylvania is looking at it. A lobbyist called me, and he's working on 5 different states. And so I'm wondering if that's something that you can back up and support. It's a no-brainer. It's not going to solve the problem, but it engages the medical community in solutions.
I think it's a great example of how advocates, because the states are where all of the ideas are really going to come from, right? They're the testing ground for all of this stuff. And so I think a lot of states are looking at California and what California has done, and they are like, well, this makes sense. You know, let's do that from here. I think drug testing, and there's some legislative proposals around drug testing because people need to know what they're taking. That's really, really important. And I think that our drug supply is so contaminated. You see this firsthand every day in the
every day.
Folks don't know what they're taking because our illicit drug supply is so contaminated. I would also suggest to folks out there that, you know, fentanyl is what's contaminating the drug supply now. But there's something, you know, there's always something that's coming. And so we need to make sure that our laws and our, you know, our made to be evergreen. And it's funny because, and I'm sure you probably saw this too, is that when I first started working in this issue area, no one talked about fentanyl. Fentanyl wasn't a thing. And now it's everything, right? It's in everything. But, you know, we'd never even heard of xylazine or nitazine. And so there's all these other drugs that are coming down the pike as well. And so people just need to be, anyone who's using drugs needs to be aware of what they're taking. And that is such a critical issue.
Yeah. Yeah. Just yesterday, I worked last night, and a guy who he thought he was using cocaine, and his drug screen, no cocaine in it. It was just fentanyl. He didn't know, and he could have died. And then another guy who was like, oh, it's just marijuana. He had no marijuana in his system, only fentanyl. I still cannot figure out what he took. And he's now in the hospital on a fentanyl, on naloxone drip. And so testing helps you, you know, it's a tool that in the hospital setting also to figure out what happened to the patient. We don't always know. So a lot of times we just assume it's fentanyl, but sometimes it's not. I've had patients also on a naloxone drip, and then we get the drug test back. There's no opiates there. It's methamphetamine and marijuana. There's, you know, so it's like, oh, okay, something else.
Yeah, I know you have talked. I've heard you speak about this a number of times. Is it just like in the emergency department that folks come in, and I do think a lot of that is genuine. They don't know what they're ingesting.
Yeah, they think they do. We had a rave at Petco Park, and I think ambulances were bringing us patients like crazy. And I asked a patient who had a seizure, and which is a big deal. I mean, you can't, now you're going to lose your driver's license for a while till we, you know, sort this out. Actually, it's a good thing that it was related to drugs, because you'll be able to get your driver's license back. And it's like, well, how do you know what you took, or what do you think you took? And he thought he took ecstasy, you know, to enjoy the music. It's like, well, how do you know it didn't have fentanyl in it? Were there fentanyl test strips around this, you know, the event? Yeah. He said, no, but I looked at other people and they looked fine. Right? And this is, you know, intelligent guy.
And it also
we need some fentanyl test strips and testings at every one of these rave parties,
and we need naloxone in everywhere.
They actually had that, you know. I'm sure there were a lot of people who were saved, but right. People were this was not, you know, people in a back alley. These were people with platinum, you know, American Express cards. Yeah. Right, who came in from around the country to this event. You know, but they didn't think that's where you needed drug testing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying.
So I'd love to see you get behind the fentanyl testing thing. If, thanks. And I'm going to take this opportunity to try to get other ideas. Okay. The other big one is at going, and I don't know if this is federal legislation, because it could just be an executive order. You're the expert on the methodology there, but getting at to the supply, all right? The supply really matters. I feel like our nation's being attacked. It's our nation. It's a North American continent problem. Like I said, with the United Nations, they're not even talking about fentanyl and declaring fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction, and illicit fentanyl, right? Not the kind that I prescribe in the emergency department, but in a way to get to the all of government approach at choking the supply. We don't have a heroin problem now. Why? Because we don't have the supply. We have a fentanyl problem now because of the supply. And I don't know if that like fits into your advocacy. You know,
like I said at the beginning of this call, often when I talk, I sound like I'm an attorney, or I sound like I'm a doctor. Which I'm neither of those things, but I really am not a counterterrorism expert. So this is really kind of outside of my expertise. I do know that the last three administrations have looked at that policy. Obama, Trump, and Biden have looked at that designation. And, you know, it comes down to kind of anti-terrorism and kind of how resources are allocated throughout the federal government, which is a very, complicated thing. But it's definitely something we're hearing about. Like, we hear about that a lot. And so, and it's definitely something we're keeping our eye on.
We're getting more. Yeah. I work with Families Against Fentanyl, and, you know, Jim Rahl lost his son to fentanyl that was traced through the phone to China. And he's doing everything to kind of prevent that supply, from lawsuits against the people from China who brought it over here, to declaring fentanyl weapon of mass destruction to get at the supply.
Yeah.
All right. Another thing. Your initiative is called Opioid Prevention Initiative. When I hear the word prevention, I think of primary prevention. And I know everything. Nowadays, everything's called prevention. And I think here's my theory of why we're spending more and more billions of dollars and not getting the results we want. Why are we spending more? Each administration, every year, we pour more and more money to this problem, and yet the problem gets worse. And the answer is why. And I think about that a lot, and I think it's not any one program. If you're talking about what you're doing with jails, of course that makes sense. Absolutely. If we're talking about harm reduction to people who are not ready for treatment, that makes sense. If we're talking about getting people to treat, getting rid of the X-waiver, all that stuff, getting naloxone out, that's all important. But I think we're not getting the results we see. And I say this because I'm studying, how did we do well with tobacco? How did we get rid of, stop the opioid prescription epidemic, which we don't have anymore? We didn't do that on what I call the back end, the small part of the population. We did that by being future oriented and saying, we don't want the next generation of Americans to be addicted to tobacco. We don't want the next generation of Americans to addicted to opioid prescriptions. Okay. And I don't see us doing that with saying, we're so immediately focused on all the naloxone there is and treatment there is, that we've lost sight that we don't want the next generation of Americans to be addicted to drugs. The stigma campaign is one of them. It's like, yes, you should not, as a doctor and in a, someone who takes care of addiction, we don't want any stigma against a human being who has a medical condition, and addiction is a medical condition, but we do want stigma on using drugs. I don't want my grandchildren using drugs, right? I don't think that's healthy. We have stigma against tobacco use, right? We don't, smoking, ew. That's like
very uncool. Ashtray,
right? That's uncool. Yeah. And I think the stigma campaign has gone to the part where it's like normalizing. We even have commercializing drug use. So my theory of why we're not getting the results we are is because our funding is focused on the small percentage of the population. If you think about it, it's like 7%. We talk about that, of the population who needs that naloxone treatment, whatever, and not looking at the 300 million Americans who need education at a young age, that life is hard. And when you get to those hard times, there's other ways to deal with life adversities without going to drugs. And that means whatever drugs, right? Yeah. Whether it's a Xanax or a marijuana or the, you know, moving on. And we have evidence-based science, you know, placebo-controlled trials of kids who got this education, kids who didn't get this education, who long-term have better educational outcome, less drug use, less violence, etc. I don't know if that's in your. I just say that because it's called the Opioid Prevention Initiative,
The Overdose Prevention Initiative. Yeah,
yeah.
And right now we are, you know, it's our ultimate metric of success is lowering the nation's overdose death rate. Right. So
yes,
we're kind of in triage mode. Right. So we are trying to address, you know, that 112,000, and 82% of those come from opioids. So, you know, in terms of where we're putting our time and effort right now is this kind of just trying to stop the bleed, to take a phrase that you used earlier. But I think I'm also the mother of a teenager. And so I actually went last month. My daughter's school had a night for parents to come and talk about this, to talk about drug use and prevention and all this kind of stuff. And I thought to myself, well, I'm an expert in this. You know, I'm just going to go in there and I'm just going to listen. And as a parent, even though I knew all the data they were going to throw out there, it still scares me as a parent. This is a whole, you know, I grew up in West Virginia in the 1980s during the middle of the Just Say No to Drugs campaign, you know, the DARE program. We all had the t-shirts, you know, and the world that I came up in, that, you know, the drug supply that I grew up with is nothing like what these kids today
are facing. It's not a death sentence.
And that is what as a parent scares me tremendously. You know, I have a 14-year-old daughter, and you know, partly because of what I do every day, I think we have honest conversations about drugs and drug policy at the dinner table. And it still scares me, you know, as a parent.
Yeah.
It definitely does. I think that, you know, at least you know, kids are getting more honest information than in the past. It's a lot less kind of scare tactics and more of, you know, here are the facts, because the facts are pretty scary.
Yeah, the facts are really scary. Exactly. This is not scare tactics. This is just real.
Exactly. But, you know, it's funny. My teenager will tell me nobody smokes. You know, she's just like,
right. There's stigma on tobacco. Exactly. So the whole issue of the stigma campaign, I think, is a little bit misguided, because when people hear, oh, we don't want stigma, it means like, oh, it's okay to use drugs.
Yeah. And I think it's fascinating. And that's an area that I really would like to kind of move us into, you know, eventually after we kind of get some.
That'd be awesome. And if I could work with you on that, because I think about that a lot. Yeah. I've talked to experts and I've had them on this podcast. It's a different way of talking to kids. It's more promoting the social norms, because most kids don't use drugs.
They don't. And actually
most kids make the choice, and that's the social norm. That's the peer pressures. Most kids make the choice to protect their brain till you're 25 years old, right?
That's what we were learning at my daughter's school, was that actually what they're leading with is the fact that actually it's a really slim minority that do. Yeah. But still, I know all the facts, right? I know all the evidence. And this is stuff that keeps me up at night as a mom. Right?
And it does, because it's not forgiving.
No.
In our days, you'd make a mistake and live through it. Okay, because what teenager doesn't make a mistake in their life? Like, who doesn't? Yeah. And now these mistakes are not forgiving, and it's not fair.
It's not.
And that's why I say our nation's being attacked, and why these parents are calling it poisoning. That, like, my child didn't overdose. My child didn't have a substance use disorder. One of the things that I would think that by this time in our overdose epidemic and drug epidemic that we would have the data on, which we don't, is, of all the people who die, which ones really did have a substance use disorder and which one were just poisoned? Because that makes a difference to what you do, because my theory is that you're not going to naloxone or treat our way out of this problem.
Yeah.
That's just the Band-Aid to keep people alive.
We have some CDC data, it's pretty slim though, on the folks who die, how many have had past interventions with the treatment system, and they're really minimal. But again, to your point, there's nothing out there that kind of connects those two dots.
Right, but because I see that, and I don't have the data, and I want to get it, when I see patients in the emergency department, some of them have a substance use disorder. I want those because I could do something for them, right? Like, I get you to treatment. I get connected. We can help you with this. But so many who've overdosed on naloxone, like yesterday, all my overdoses, and sadly I have them every day, none of them had a substance use disorder or that they admitted to. You know, I don't know. Like, they may not tell me the truth. But they say that they didn't intend to use fentanyl.
Yeah. It's terrifying. Again, as a parent, it terrifies me. So,
right.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's all It's wonderful to talk to you. I love having these discussions. There's another, like, I think there's some federal bills out there in protecting yep. against the Delta products. I don't know if that is in your...
It's not. Yeah.
I think it should be. Because this, again, it has to do, if you like go upstream, you know, mm-hmm. downstream is people in jail and then the naloxone. And that's important because, you know, we have to keep people alive. They don't deserve to die. Yeah. But if we want to go upstream, then I think we need to have those conversations about marijuana and drug use. And the Farm Act opened up mm-hmm. all these yeah. Delta products that were never tested on rats or mice. They're being tested, first of all, on our children. And they're in the stores and in the malls legally. And so I think that this, there's a bill, if you're interested in this, I can connect
I'll
you.
I'll write it down. I've got my...
With a person.
Yeah.
yeah. Who, I don't know if that like fits your, you know, your mission, but I think that's important consumer protection, mm-hmm. That's out there. So yeah, the fentanyl bill and the Delta products, I'll put in your
email.
Yeah. Okay. And then, so tell us what else, there's a lot of proposed legislation, which you told us the ones that you're looking at. And what do you think the future of overdose poisoning, I want to use the word poisoning also, prevention look like? Because I feel like not everyone who is dying has a substance use disorder.
I think the future, you know, it's so important to get these stories out. You know, there are so many people. I mean, there are more than 20 million Americans who are currently in recovery. Every single one of those folks has an important testament that they need to make about the importance of not only treatment, but that there's hope. And I think that, you know, I don't want that the substance use and overdose policy to get to a point where we feel like we have no hope, right? There is a lot of hope.
And always hope. Always hope.
I think the future also looks like those diverse coalitions that came together for the MAD Act. I think that we're going to, you know, that, you know, public health and public safety, to your earlier point about like what you can do on a local level, mm-hmm. like a lot of this is going to come down to what your state and your local governments are doing. And that what's going to drive that is those coalitions that are coming together at the local level. And that's where a lot of this is going to happen. You know, a lot of our job here in DC is to just get the federal government out of the way, eliminate barriers like the X waiver so that doctors can treat their patients and that the state and local governments can make the changes that they need to address what's going on in their neighborhoods. And then I think the other kind of part that I really want to address in the work that we're doing is addressing the persistent equity gaps and the treatment gaps. You know, we talk about that, you know, 12% of only 12% of Americans who need treatment are actually getting it. If you break that down by race, that gap is even more. It is even more vast, and we yeah. need to, and a lot of that is based in stigma. A lot of that is based in kind of structural racism that's existed in our, you know, in our health and treatment systems for a long time. And so that's it's a bigger thing. It's a long-term thing, but I think that's where I would like to see the future of overdose prevention going, is really making an effort to address those health equity gaps. And some of those, you know, really well, taking
different
downstream
different
upstream
cultures are more susceptible genetically and socially to drugs, and speaking to different groups is a different way of reaching them. So, you know, filling that need, I think I agree with you. Just one thing, I was going to just let it pass, but I'm very familiar with the SAMHSA data on the 12%.
Yeah.
Right. That if we look at the data specifically, it's people who have a substance use disorder, mm-hmm. only 12% of them receive treatment at a treatment facility, mm-hmm. right? Not all of them need treatment at a treatment yeah. facility. So it makes the gap seem way, way bigger than it really is. It's not that it's not big. It is big, but it's probably a little bit smaller because we know, and you could, you know that from looking at recovery, people who are living in recovery, 20 million people are living in recovery. How many of them went to a treatment facility to get into recovery? Not the majority. So that tells us that there's other ways. No one size fits all.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought that up because it's, I think that another myth that we need to bust is this idea that treatment is going away to some inpatient treatment facility or that, you know, you're exactly right. There is no one size fits all. And that's why kind of incorporating substance use treatment into healthcare, right? Yeah. It is a chronic recurring brain disorder, right? And it should be treated as such. You know, I can't imagine, you know, someone with being treated for diabetes, having to go every day to pick up an insulin if they're stable and their, you know, condition is being managed. So we need to kind of look at how these chronic diseases are treated and treat this just the same way. So you're exactly
right. Yeah. And some people want to try to lose weight and exercise and get rid of, or have a gastric bypass and now they, or something, then they don't have their diabetes anymore. And some people, it's like, you know what? If you want to be alive, you need to be an insulin pump for the rest of your life. That's just
the way it is. Exactly. Exactly. And this is a disease that is in some ways just like any other chronic disease. And if we continue to segregate substance use disorder outside of our healthcare system, you know, we will not be able to address, you know, this crisis.
But also, if there was stigma to using drugs and our campaign was focused on protecting the brain until age 25, we would have less addiction of all drugs in our country, period.
And we have to educate not only kids, but parents, you know?
Yeah, because and we're fighting, and this may be political, maybe not, but we're fighting. There's a movement out there that wants to normalize drug use. Saw it in the United Nations, and we see it in advocacy groups. And their tagline is like, you have your wine, I have my line. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's a philosophy. That. Some people believe that, but I think my opinion is that that's not what I want for America's youth. I think that's a health risk.
You know, I'm very lucky to talk to doctors every day who are really on the front lines. And, you know, some of the stories that they tell us are just very harrowing. So, you know, I thank you for all of your work and your passion on this. You know, we were talking to a physician here in DC last week who was saying that 5 years ago when they did a survey or did an analysis of the drug supply in Washington, DC, it was like 12% fentanyl. And now the samples that they took was 98% fentanyl. And it's changing, you know, this is just one case study of one city, but it's changing very quickly.
Yeah, it's deadly. Again, why the supply really, it matters. Anyway, Libby, it's always great to talk to you. I so appreciate the time we had together in DC.
I'm so glad we got a chance to connect.
I know. I jump to any recurring opportunities like that with you. I thank you for what you do, for being a fighter. But I think what makes you such a great fighter is that you're a great listener. And then know how to navigate things. And thank you for joining us and teaching us on High Truths.
And thank you for all that you do.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.
Thank you.